From Lech Mecheberitz, Binyamin Hamer, National Council Young Israel, we welcome Rabbi Willig to our conference call number 51. Thank you, Rebbe.
Pleasure. Question number one. Our shul's bylaws do not allow a woman to be president, nor vice president. We currently have a 9-person board, including 2 women, who serve, and with elections coming up next week, possibly a third. To date, their titles have been recording secretary and educational secretary. A. If another woman is elected, can she be given the title of treasurer? B. Our minimum quorum is 5 for a meeting. If 3 of those members that show up are women and they vote together against the other 2 male board members, we would have a majority at least for that meeting of women. Is that permissible? The issue here is what we call sorora. Now, this is a very difficult term to define. The Rambam seems to say that a woman should not occupy a position of sorora. Sorora is sometimes translated as authority. It comes from Melech v'lo Malka, but the Rambam extends it to other positions based upon the Gemara. The Gemara's case is someone who was in charge of the water supply in the town. It's hard to define. It seems to me that there's room to be lenient with respect to a treasurer, because the treasurer, when doing a job properly, dispenses monies and collects monies. As for the instructions of the president and the other members of the administration, if they say, write a check to X, she writes to X. If they say membership is Y, everyone gives a Y. She's not exercising authority as such. Now, of course, it could be that, you know, as they say in Yiddish, one who has the Schlüssel, one has the keys, one has the checkbook, has certain de facto authority. That may be true, but it's not sufficient to disqualify a woman, as far as I can see, from serving as treasurer. As far as the second scenario, I do not believe it's true either. Just so happens they happen to be 3 against 2. That's just a coincidence. And the board itself is not such a position of authority in and of itself. No one of the 3 women has so much authority herself either. For all those reasons and others, I don't believe it's a problem. Question 2. The nusach of the shul is nusach Sfarad. Personally, I daven nusach Ashkenaz. As the rabbi of the shul, what should I daven? Should I change my nusach? The shul certainly won't change theirs. Strictly speaking, a person is supposed to daven according to his own nusach. In this case, that would presumably be nusach Ashkenaz. Unless, by adhering to your own nusach, it is noticeable to others that you are veering away from the nusach of the shul. For example, the person davens Ashkenaz and everyone else in the shul is davening Sfarad. So for example, on Mondays and Thursdays, Sfarad falls tachlin before the Hurachim and Ashkenaz the other way around. So I believe if you're an Ashkenaz person davening in the Sfarad shul, you're required to follow the minhag of Sfarad. Should not be noticeable that you are not doing what they are doing. And if and people are screaming out the nusach of Kedusha, so you should be saying Shabbos Musaf, you should be saying Keser, not Naritzcha, because that's the nusach of the nusach Sfarad. But this is prominent in Rav Moshe's Shuvos and other places. Ideally, you're supposed to stick to your own nusach, except when it's conspicuous that you're not following the nusach of the shul, you have to follow the shul, nusach of the shul. Now, having said that, that's an ideal. If you can't, because you'd be confused, you're Ashkenaz, you're Sfarad, and you have to halt kup how not to be noticeable as being different from the people around you, especially the Rav, I believe it would be permissible to, for the moment, daven according to the nusach of the shul where you serve, which is Sfarad. It's not a change forever. As long as you're serving at the Rav in that shul and there's Sfarad, if it's hard for you to maintain an independent nusach without being confused. And if it's easier for you to change the nusach, which is not so easy either, then it's permissible. Question 3. In general, if I daven in a shul that daven is differently than my personal nusach, and I bring my young son to shul, what should I teach him? If I teach him my nusach, he will have trouble following along in davening since the shul is davening differently. If I teach him the shul nusach, then I'm not teaching him my family's mesorah. Also, I daven according to my nusach, except the parts of davening that said aloud, as we just said. Won't this confuse my son? Again, I believe the son will be confused because he doesn't know. He's a young kid. How's he going to figure out to go here, to change? Now it's Ashkenaz, now it's Sfarad, now it's loud, now it's soft. That'll be confusing. So therefore, the son should probably daven according to the nusach of the shul. Now, when you say young son, it's not clear if he's of yeshiva age, because yeshivas also have minyan. So I would say if the yeshiva and the shul daven the same minyan, the same nusach, different from the fathers, then it's better he should daven that nusach, because he won't get confused, not in shul and not in school. When he gets older, it's preferred that he go back to the nusach of his ancestors, of his father and grandfather. He's not changing again in principle, just it's a matter of expediency. How are you going to get to daven better without being confused? That's an important consideration. This is relevant, incidentally, to Havara as well as Nusach, which you've spoken about in the past, but that's a different story. Question number 4. When it comes to a Keurig coffee machine, I have a different opinions regarding Tevila. Some say to sell the machine to a goy. Some say since it can't be told by definition, it does not require Tevila. Some say since it can only function while plugged in, it is considered attached to the ground, it does not require Tevila. Can discuss these options. Also, since I think everyone would agree that it is not a necessity to have a correct coffee machine, should one be more stringent since it is not possible to toivel it? The answer is as follows. If, in fact, it's impossible to be toivel it, there's no need to be toivel it. Tefillas Kelim is a mitzvah. If it cannot be done, you're potter. And there's no need to be strict and not to use it. Even though you don't need it. So what? You're allowed to use it anyway, even though it's not an absolute necessity. Because there's nothing wrong with using a kli without tefila if, in point of fact, tefila is impossible. It's ruin the machine. Again, tefila is a mitzvah to do, not an avera to not do. Now, therefore, there's no need to avoid it. There's no need to sell it to a goy. And avocado dip if it's similar to tuna salad. Shmir Shabbos Kachosa in Perek Ches, Sifchav Ches, Horat Tzadi Beis, says there's no Easter of Tchina, of grinding, if it's Samach Lusuda, if it's close to the meal, Bechatichos Gidolos Ktsas, with pieces that are a little bit bigger than usual, even with respect to Yerokos, such as onions, which may be in this kind of a salad, or celery. With respect to fish and eggs, which are more lenient because they don't go from the ground, then it's even more lenient as far as the Easter of Tochein is concerned. And so again, you should do it Tamach L'Suda, close to the Suda in larger pieces than usual. That problem is more readily solved. The bigger problem that we call Lush. Lush is kneading. Flour and water, make a dough. That is called Lush. The Gemara has a distinction between a Belila Oven and a Belila Raka. We'll call one a batter and one a dough. One pours, one doesn't. And the Belila Ova, which is more comparable to the classic case of flour and water, is much more strict. The Belila Raka is more lenient. The problem over here, it's very likely that we should consider it to be a Belila Ova. The tuna salad doesn't pour, and that's a serious issue. It really shouldn't be done according to the books. The Shmir Shabbos there, he quotes the Minig Olam is to be lenient. And he tries to find reasons why we can be lenient. And he suggests a number of svaras. Number one, it's a small amount. And there's a leniency in the Gemara and the Masechta Shabbos for a small amount. Number two, some say if the salad is not thin like flour, there's no Yisrael Elisha. Here it's obviously the pieces aren't so thin. Number three of Shlomo Zalman suggests when you knead dough, you want it to come into one big piece. Here, Badafka, you want to be careful it should not become one big piece. You want the parts of the salad to remain separate. In addition, of Shlomo Zalman says it's pre-cooked, assuming it is. Mevusha before, the tuna, the eggs, is all cooked before. There's, again, more room to be lenient. And therefore, the Shemir Shabbos writes, he's justifying the custom to do it in the normal fashion, which is done by Gedoli HaTorah Vayira, even though it's not so simple why it should be, in fact, the case. We'll see soon what possible leniencies could be applied to this case, and perhaps they should. Question number six, is it permissible to spray whipped cream on Shabbos or on Yom Tov? We are generally treating Shabbos the same, although in this context it could be that Yom Tov is even more strict. The Easter of, we call over here, of molid, potentially. Molid means a change of state. If you look in Siman Shin Yud Ches Sifta Zayin, you get an impression the Mechaber holds it's permissible. Even the Ramah says you should avoid it. It doesn't seem to be an absolute prohibition. It seems to me that molded is a complete change of physical state from absolute solid to absolute liquid or vice versa, from liquid or solid to gas and vice versa. Was an airman about that. But in the case of the whipped cream spray from a can, it seems to me that it didn't start off as a full liquid and didn't end off as a full solid. The aerosol can has something which is inside of it, a liquid which is thick. And apparently when you press the nozzle and the spray comes out, it hardens somewhat, doesn't become an absolute solid. That's the way the aerosol can works. Since the entire prohibition is itself questionable, the Mechaber doesn't hold from it. Ramah is also Megel B'Shas HaTzchak. It seems to me in this case where it didn't start off as a full liquid, doesn't end up as a full solid, the change is more incremental, presumed to be lenient. Question number seven. If one purchases or receives a prepackaged chocolate platter on a glass tray that was not tabled, must the chocolate be removed from the tray before serving it? May one continue to use the tray without tevila? The Sefer Tevilas Kalim, a beautiful Sefer, Rav Tzvi Kohn from Bnei Brak, came out years ago, discusses this on page Kuf Beis in the Sefer. Wants to know, if the kli was not tovled, is the prohibition eating from a non-tovled kli, or is it placing the food on a non-tova kli. Look on the back on the Maftechus and page Resh Pei, discusses it at greater length. Seems to me we should be strict and say it's a problem even of eating off such a kli. The Rambam's expression may indicate that. And the way to do it is to take the food off the tray, put it on a different tray. And after you're finished and you're ready to use it again, you have to obviously have to put it into a mikvah. Be tovel it yourself. Question 8. If you have to shorten shlosha for an avo, does it also affect this kedima to daven from the omad or merely after yomtiv? Or does kedima from the omad still last 30 days, yomtiv or not? Mr. Brewer addresses this in his famous Maimer Kaddishin, in the Bialocha, Simon Kuflam Advais, and he says, 30 days is 30 days, even if it goes through a Yontif. Yontif knocks off the practices of mourning, but as far as matters relate to Bezn Shalmala, to the heavenly court, which is what this fits into, then 30 days is 30 days, irrespective of Yontif. So the Kadima does exist even beyond the Yontif. 9. Can you apply suntan lotion on a child on Shabbos and on Yom Tov? If indeed it's a liquid, it's permissible. If it's a cream, it's not. I'm not an expert in suntan lotion. Again, you should purchase one which is a liquid and not a cream. I think they exist, if I'm not mistaken. And of course, when you put it on, you have to be careful. You're better off using your hands, if that's possible. Whatever surface it's placed on, you have to worry about schita if you try to squeeze it out of that surface. If it's cotton balls and things of this nature, or a garment. So that's a separate question. Okay. 10. I have a balabais in my shul who is looked up to by many in the community. His wife has shared with my wife and me very difficult stories regarding their shalom bias, although we are not professional therapists. Even a small amount of what she claims is true, it is certainly very abusive. They have seen many therapists together. It appears that when he feels cornered, he walks out and demands to see a different therapist. After many years, only she sees one by herself. The woman has some married children and some in shidduchim. She does not want to leave him because she feels that a broken home for children is worse than the abuse she is taking. Is that an abused woman talking or a Torah hashkafa? What is my responsibility here? You know, someone's an either-or question. The answer is both. It could be an abused woman talking, but nay still coincide with the Torah's hashkafa in the following sense. She already suffered so much. Could be that the Hashkafas HaTorah allows her to continue to suffer in order to help her children. It presumably would help her children to find Shidduchim. When they're in the parish of Shidduchim right now, divorce is a stigma. And even on a practical level, without stigmatization, people would like to have their child marry a child from an intact family. It makes life that more easy and pleasant. So I understand why she'd want to hold out longer, and I do not think that contradicts the Torah's Hashkafa. It's not a perfect marriage. I'm the first to admit that. But nonetheless, the exception if her life was in danger. But if he's hitting her, life was in danger, she should just don't ask a rabbi, call for an order of protection. It's pikuach nefesh. But you know, I assume the abuse that's being described here is what we'll call verbal abuse, which of course comes in many levels and many gradations. But even assuming it's on the more severe level, it does not pose a danger to life. Yisurim are difficult. No one's looking for Yisurim. Yisurim can lead to what we call kapara. This is not to advocate Yisurim, certainly not at the hands of an abusive husband, chas v'sholom. It's not an ideal situation. I'm assuming for the moment that the children will be better served by the couple staying together. Now, there are those who claim in certain extreme cases the children are better off if the couple divorces than if they stay together and have World War III. That may be so, and every case is different. But by and large, it seems to me that the research shows that divorce is harmful, even if the child picks up the parents aren't doing well together. As long as it's not physically dangerous, it may be worthwhile for the woman to stay in the marriage as long as the children are in shidduchim. If they all get married, she wants to leave him then, that's her choice. Again, this is not in any way to be misinterpreted that I'm condoning any kind of abuse, whether it be emotional, whether it be verbal. Chas v'shalom, it's the worst thing. But if a woman's already in this relationship for quite a while, and she's managed to be there long enough that she has to marry children, she's been there for 20-something years at least, to leave now when the children are shidduchim, I don't know if that's the Torah Hashkafa either. Yeah, just stick it out a little bit longer and marry off the kids, and then is what to talk about. Maybe then it'll get better. I doubt it, but anything's possible. Of course, if she wants to leave, it's a different story. I don't think the rabbi's responsibility is to tell her to leave in this case unless it's a physical danger to her. You just go over the facts with her. She's in a bad situation. Your heart goes out to her. You feel bad that she's being abused. It's completely intolerable. At the same time, in the interest of the children, if you want to stay in this relationship, however weakened it may be, I don't believe it's against the Torah Hashkafa to allow it to continue, at least as far as the children being in the home are concerned. Okay, question number 11. As a follow-up to last conference call about the Swifter Sweeper, there's also a variety with a wet cloth, or wet ones on Shabbos. Start again. A wet cloth, can you use it on Shabbos? The answer is no. Sorry, I skipped something. You may not use a wet cloth on Shabbos because of Schita. What about a baby wipes or wet ones on Shabbos? In my opinion, it's also Schita. A lot of literature has been written about the baby wipes. Much of the literature is about arguments and the facts. Does the liquid come out or doesn't it come out when one uses a baby wipe? My experience is liquid, in fact, does come out. In my experience, that liquid is desirable by the person who's cleaning the baby so that when the liquid comes out, it makes it easier to clean. If that's the case, it seems to me, it's a very serious problem of schita, although I know others disagree on the facts. Some say opposite direction. Some say no water comes out. And some say there's so much water that there's not even need for the water to come out, just on the outside. So this indicates that maybe the need of them is right. And there's a little bit absorbed inside, which comes outside by the pressure, which to me is a serious question of schita, and I think they should not be used. Other rabbanim have different opinions. Of course, one can rely on other rabbanim as well, but in my view, they should not be used. Okay, question number C, carpet sweeper on Shabbos. You look at Shemir Shabbos, Kilchasa, Perek Chav Gimel, Sivdali prohibits it, based on the Bialacha, Simon Shin Lamed Zayin, Sivbeis. He's called an Uvda Dechol and a Zilzul the Shabbos, as the Bach in fact holds. It seems to me that's a significant consideration, and we should avoid the carpet sweeper on Shabbos. D, may one allow the non-Jewish maintenance worker to use a vacuum cleaner on Shabbos or to clean up after the Kiddush and Shul? Would halacha be different in a private home? Well, you know, you can't ask a non-Jew to do work for you on Shabbos. It's true that according to the role of poskim against the Chazon Ish, putting on a vacuum cleaner is an issur derabanan because completing an electric circuit is not an issur d'oraisa. Not everyone agrees that it's not a d'oraisa, but most seem to agree with that. So what? You're still not supposed to tell the guy to do a malacha derabanan under normal circumstances either. There is a concept of shvus malacha mitzvah. Yes, that's in a pinch. We should try to find a way out of this situation, if it's at all possible, a different way. Now, speaking about different ways, look at Shmir Shabbos Kachosa. Again, in Perek Chav Gimel, Ha'ara Yud Ches, he says, look, you could clean this surface with a broom. You just wipe lightly with a broom. It could take much more tedious. May not be as good a job, but it can get done. And therefore, he suggests, since he could have done it with a broom, I'm not required to protest if he happens to do it with a vacuum cleaner. I may not tell him to do it with a vacuum cleaner, but some of them just do it on their own. There is another problem called avshamilsa. It's very public, this noise, these vacuums, even today, less noise than previous years. They're still making more noise than typical appliances. And that's another potential issue. Better not to do it. If it has to be done, let the non-Jewish help put on the vacuum cleaner after everybody left the shul. Less of an issue of avshamilsa if people are no longer in the shul. Now, even if you hold that electricity is a deraisa, there are some who say that you're allowed to ask a goy to do even a malacha deraisa, p'mokam tzorche rabin. It's based on a Tosfos in Gittin Daf Ches about Amir Lenochi to buy land in Eretz Yisrael. So some understand it one or the other way. There may be a source for this din. So there's another tzad lehokel in this case. You have to judge each case separately. It's better to avoid it and wait till after Shabbos to make the cleanup. There's another affair coming in. So you'll have a one-day caterer, a lunch, they cater a Shalosh Shudder, so they cater Friday night. And you have to make it clean for the next round. Then again, it's better to use broom, but in the Shas HaTzchak, it's hard to tell the guy to do it with a vacuum cleaner, even though that may be permissible based on Shvus, Shvus, B'malka Mitzvah, or Shvus, B'malka Mitzvah, the Rabbi. Better to avoid telling him explicitly. They usually get the hint. But nonetheless, it's probably better yet to tell him to use a broom, and if it's not a perfect job, that should be good enough. Again, depends on who the next customer is. Every case is different. Question number 12. Many of the women seem to be wearing fresh makeup on Shabbos. Should a rabbi speak out about this or just let it be? In general, the machlokes Shabbos makeup, Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman. Rav Moshe is more makeup than Rav Shlomo Zalman in Shabbos makeup. Not exactly clear what qualifies for his leniency, because most of the makeup these days does in fact adhere to the skin. I'm not sure if Rav Moshe's fact pattern still exists now. It's not clear. Sometimes one would say that, the prior principle of mutav shu'u shogin v'ayim mezidin. These are fundamentally Shomer Shabbos women, but somehow, maybe from their mothers or some or other, they got used to this leniency of putting on makeup on Shabbos, even assuming it's prohibited. She doesn't know about it, or she relies on some leniency which normatively we don't accept. It seems to me that if a person wants to speak about this, he should speak about it in front of his male audience. We learn Hilchos Shabbos. That's no problem. Goes home to his wife and tells her, it's better that you shouldn't do this. That's not so direct. Or maybe a woman's shir. Women come into a shir. It's sort of a self-selected group of those who are really more interested in keeping Shabbos kedatz kedin. So in that kind of a circle, it's probably appropriate. But to make an announcement in front of the whole shul, so first of all, you're insulting, could be hundreds of women who came to shul with the makeup on. Now you're saying it's not allowed. It's itself a problem. So you have to balance these two considerations, trying to keep the dikduk halacha, which means without this makeup. At the same time, you have to know when to be quiet. Could be counterproductive to say something. Again, every case is different. So let's go to the next question. Question 13. What bracha should be said for rice cakes? Boromir Mazonos, I think that's pretty clear. Granola bars. Oh, that's not clear at all. Some say Boromir Mazonos. Some say Boromir Adama. Some say Shakal Nibidvaro. I cannot express an opinion on this matter. It's very complex. It depends on many considerations. The status of oats in general, the status of rolled oats, the status of snack bars or whatever granola bar may be called. I can't give a psak, and therefore maybe it's better to avoid granola bars. Maybe better for other reasons too. If you're using it, maybe you should better make a shahako. Although it's very possible that Adama is more likely the correct bracha, maybe even mezonos. But I'm sorry, I'm unable to give a better answer than that as far as granola bars are concerned. Is a bracha supposed to be made for on Listerine strips? The answer to that question, I believe, is no. It's not a food. It's just a breath freshener. What about desserts? Is there a difference between cake, cooked fruit, raw fruit, nuts, chocolate, or jello? Wow. Exhaustive list. It seems to me, and I go with machlokes in all directions, that a person should make a bracha on a fruit dessert, whether the dessert is raw fruit or the dessert is cooked fruit. Either way, a bracha is appropriate. Why? It's called ikaron le kinuach seuda. It's not meant to fill you up. It's meant to finish the meal with some kind of a sweet or pleasant taste in your mouth. That's called kinuach seuda. And whatever comes for that purpose of kinuach seuda requires, by our custom, a brewery parades towards the end of the meal. And therefore, I think that bracha should be made because it's basically not to fill you up at all. It's just to give you a sweet taste in your mouth. That's what kinuach seuda means. The other example of that, I believe, is jello. I think it's an ad. There's always room for jello. And now I can't believe necessarily truth in advertising, but it's very, very non-filling. It's just basically sugar and water, I think. You can keep having almost as much as you want. And therefore, I believe that a person who has jello for dessert should make a shakal niyabidvara, because it's made for kinuach seuda. It's a kind of a sweet taste to let the food go down better and taste better at the end of the meal. The other ones are much more complex. There is the question of cake. Cake, the Mishnah Berurah passing, they shouldn't make a bracha on cake, because maybe cake is bread. Because there are three opinions in the Gemara, in the Shulchan Aruch, what's the definition we call pas haba b'kisnin? Pas haba b'kisnin, as you know, the bracha is before it's borrowed mezonos, and the bracha afterwards is ala michya. Let's say kovei asud on it. Let's put that aside for the moment. Assuming this is not part of a kovei asud, the Mishnah Berurah still is concerned because there are three definitions of pas haba b'kisnin. We'll say cakes which are sugary, such as sponge cake, chocolate cake. Then you have foods which are like pies. You have a hard crust, but there's some pie filling, things of this nature, cherry pie. Even though the crust is purely flour and water, doesn't matter. Then you have the chocolate cake, which is flour, water, but also sugar and chocolate. Then you have hard crackers. Mr. Brewer suggests, since all three are found, so we make mezonos on all three only mishum suffik. We're not sure if it's bread or if it's cake. I should say we're not sure if it's hamotzi or mezonos. We make mezonos. But the other way around, to determine with certainty that it is mezonos and not hamotzi, we cannot do that either. Therefore, at the end of the meal, if it would be hamotzi, the benching would take care of it. It would not be appropriate to the washing and benching. It might take care of it. So therefore, the Mishnah Berurah seems to be noted when it's a doubtful pas kisnin not to make a bracha. One could argue against the simple read of the Shulchan Aruch and say that really all three are pas haba b'kisnin because the definition of pas kisnin is what's made for a snack as opposed to regular pot bread which is made for the main part of the meal, the centerpiece of the meal. And therefore, if I'm right, and other posts can say that, then there's no chance of a piece of cake being Hamosi. It's certainly possible because nu, according to the Shulchan Aruch, you should make a bracha. Well, the answer to Rashba says you don't make a bracha on possible because at the end of the meal. More than that, the reason why pas kistin you would make a bracha, according to those who say so, is because since it's kind of a sweet food, it's meant, again, the kinuach su'uda. It's just because it's sweet and not meant to fill you up. So you have a doubt about that. You know, maybe you're not completely full. You're still hungry a little bit and the cake fills you up. If you have a doubt in that, the Sefer Megillah Sefer on Kesem Averoch, on the great Sefer, Rav Eisenthal from Yerushalayim, on page Kuf Lamed Hey, he says, Safek Brachos Lahakum. In other words, when you talk about fruits or jello, the assumption is that it's fundamentally just giving you a sweet taste. It's not filling you up. And therefore, a bracha should be made because if it's a dessert. I guess in theory, if a person washes, and his whole main meal is just fruit, then perhaps he would not make a bracha because that's the main part of the meal. That's what fills you up. But in our cases, he already had his whole meal and his belly is full, just having fruit to give him a sweet taste. Then a bracha, bar praise, should be made with respect to cake. Even though you had a full meal, there's maybe still some hunger and you feel the cake will fill you up more. I know for one, I feel that way often. I don't try not to eat that much. Shouldn't be eating so much cake either. If the cake comes out after I had a meal, I didn't overeat, the cake does fill me, and therefore I think it's appropriate to omit the bracha based on the Megillah Sefer, combined with the sheet of the Rashba. You can throw on the Mishnah Berurah for good measure. Seems to me the same would apply to nuts and chocolate. Not everyone agrees with me on that, but nuts and even chocolate are somewhat filling. And that being said, it's a better chance that it's potter with the hamotzi, as opposed to making a shahakal and a chocolate and a bar parades on the nuts. So I would say again, Savi Brahmas Lahakal. Okay. Question number 14. A balabayit with a large family and many financial responsibilities has a Down syndrome daughter who is now a teen. She is reasonably functioning, going to special school, considering her condition. Would like to know if he can use Maisa to set up a trust to benefit the child when he and his wife might no longer be able to do so. I'm not sure what the parentheses mean, so I'm going to leave it out. The answer is, a parent's obligation to a child is until the child can become independent. The time of the Gemara, that may have been a very early age of 6, but nowadays it's no longer 6. And the chief rabbinate, a long time ago, raised the age from 6, which is found in the Gemara, to 15. In those days, in the 40s, when you hit 15, you were able to be somewhat independent. You'd be somewhat independent. And later, birthday din, these days, when we discuss in end of marriage situations how long the father is responsible for the financial upkeep of his child, birthday din goes to 18, to 21, some even later if they pay college tuitions. That's the meaning nowadays. That's the fundamental principle concerning a parent's obligation, fundamentally a father's obligation, to support his children according to the halacha. It seems to me, therefore, that in the case that's being described in this question, which is a Down syndrome daughter who presumably will never be independent, the parent's responsibility is much more significant, probably forever, for the lifetime of the child. Obviously, if the parents aren't no longer in this world, you can't make them formally responsible. But at the same time, since Derech Olam, even Down syndrome children who are high functioning will outlive their parents, it's not inappropriate for money to be put aside as part of the parent's responsibility. I'm not using the word miser. Miser is beyond the family. But someone who has such a serious financial responsibility towards a child, it's possible such an individual is exempt from miser. Miser only kicks in when the person has enough money to take care of the family. It's arguable that in this case, they don't have enough money to take care of the family, because taking care of the family would include putting aside money for the Down syndrome daughter. If after they put aside an appropriate amount of money for the Down syndrome daughter, they have expendable income, then it'd be chayv and miser. So I'm not answering that they are to use this money for miser. I'm saying that if they have this tremendous responsibility, they may be putter for miser. That's a whole different story. And therefore, I don't think there'd be a chiyuv of miser. I think that the person should, the couple should look carefully and find out what kind of governmental assistance exists in such cases. Could be that, you know, if after 120, if such a child has no parents and has no support system, that the government would take care of most of the expenses. It's only relevant so that the trust need not be so large, in which case there may be more of a possibility that they would have enough money to live on, including that expense, and then they'd be able to give maaser from the excess. Question 15. The Aron Kodesh and Mashul faces south. Mishnah Brura says that in this scenario it is proper to face east, but if one comes to such a shul and everyone else is facing south, one should face south and turn his face east. Everyone in Mashul davened towards the Aron Kodesh facing south and have done such for as long as they have been davening there. Should I try to have everyone daven facing east, or should we continue davening facing south? Now the Mishnah Brura that's being quoted over here is in Siman Sadi Dalet Siv Katan Ches. However, the same author in the Bir Alocha, Simon Kufnun, the Ramaskal Shahu, is Mesupik. He's not sure. In the Bar Hetev, in Simon Sadi Dallas, is Katan Gimel. There are two opinions. And therefore, the Mishnah Brewer himself seems to not have resolved this issue definitively. If you look in Rashi, in Brochus, Chuvas Rambam, and maybe even Tosus might agree, that on the contrary, it's better they should face the Aron Kodesh and not face east. Moreover, the Aruch HaShulchan writes, it's enough to face a little bit to the east to satisfy the requirement to face towards Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, it seems to me they should continue to daven in the way they are davening, and just those who are careful should do... should do the same thing. Face south, as the Mishnah Berurah says, and tilt a little bit towards the east. Question number 16. The young man in the community has OCD, which he has been dealing with through counseling and a lot of personal work. He is doing much better than when I first met him. He is now in Shidduchim, and I'm often called as a reference. Often I'm asked, is there anything else that you think I should know? I have not said he is OCD, but rather have been responding that I think he's wonderful, and as it progresses, you should feel free to check in with me after the third or fourth date. I don't want to damage his opportunities, and even though the right girl may be scared off by the stigma of such a label, but I don't want to withhold proper information. Is there a better balance to be recommended? My fear is that answer itself will cause wonderment, and people will just run away. Ideally, the best thing should be done is that the boy himself should tell the girl at that stage. The rabbi says, check that we got a third or fourth date. Maybe after the third or fourth date, the boy should tell the girl about his situation. And the rabbi, instead of saying it himself down the road, should tell the boy that, you know, he didn't disclose this. He's assuming that the boy will disclose it, and he will... in fact, see to it that the boy discloses. Chas v'shalom, to fail to disclose significant psychological problems such as OCD. That would be a terrible, terrible thing, which could have horrific consequences. It must be disclosed. The question is only when. So there are different levels, you know. There is the very, very extreme case, which should be told about in advance before they even meet. Maybe they shouldn't meet if they're not prepared to deal with it. Then there are the very minor issues, which I wouldn't even call psychological illnesses. I'd call the minor stuff that many people go through, a little minor anxiety. That's not so significant at all. But I think OCD, certainly, once he's diagnosed with that, it rises to the level of significance that it must be disclosed. So the rabbi can do what he's been doing until now, call me after 3 or 4 dates, but that itself might scare away people. I think if he's asked, is there anything else you think I should know? So a proper answer is, look, the boy should get to meet the boy and you'll judge for yourself. And you tell the boy that he has to disclose this after 3 or 4 dates, as the rabbi would have done on his own. Is 3 or 4 dates exactly the right time? No, no about that. Some suggest you should do it at the halfway point, but of course, the halfway point is like a radioactive half-life. You never know how long it's going to go. It depends on what kind of circle you belong to. You look in a sefer called Bina B'Shidduch, quote from the Chazon Ish, that some cases can be disclosed towards the end. We've spoken about this in the past. Rav Moshe was very lenient not to disclose certain things, and my Rebbe the Rav also. I feel these things should be disclosed more than they do, but not at the very beginning. And when I receive complaints after the couple went out for a month and the girl disclosed some minor mental health issues, I got an irate phone call from the mother of the boy. How could you let my boy waste a month of his time? I refer to Rav Moshe's famous tshuva where he says a woman doesn't have to disclose a much more serious issue. She didn't have any period. And he said, well, they should make a deal in advance, and in case the treatments after marriage don't work and she can't have any children, that she'll agree to receive a get without any issues after 3 years. This way the boy doesn't suffer that much. I always say that much. He used to be the best bachur in Lakewood at 22. Now he's a 26-year-old divorcee. I don't know. That seems to be a lot. I wouldn't agree with that psak because it's such a major issue. 20-year-old girl has no period. But here it's a much less significant issue, and indeed it's a much less significant time. I think you do have to disclose it, but not at the very beginning. Next question. I've received a few shailos recently about Ashkenazim eating meat from the hindquarters after Nikur. There are Rabbanim who approve of this basar menuka. Do you think it's permitted for Ashkenazim to eat meat? No, they should not be eating this meat. Many, many years Ashkenazim do not eat from this part of the meat. Sephardim do, Ashkenazim don't. The OU, for example, does not approve of such meat. I don't think the person should be eating this meat, even if it's mutar mikra adin. Long, long standing meaning of Ashkenazim not to use it is, I believe, appropriate to follow. Next question. May one make instant oatmeal on Shabbos, applying hot water or milk to the dried flakes? There seems to be differing opinions on this issue. Well, it breaks down to two different issues. As far as Bishul is concerned, it seems to me that in most cases it can be lenient on the grounds of Ein Bishul Achar Bishul, because the dried flakes are dry, considered to be Yovesh. And the presumption is that these flakes have been previously cooked. I want to check that out to make sure, but almost all instants, the reason that it cooks so instantly is because it's been previously cooked and then just dehydrated. So if that's in fact the case, there's room to be lenient from the perspective of Bishul. The bigger problem is what we call lush, which we spoke about earlier today. It's most cereals have what we'll call a blila ova is a somewhat thicker kind of mixture. It doesn't just pour out. It's more like a dough than a batter, although it's not as hard as a hard dough. It's something in between. And when it comes to a blila ova, the poskim say we should really not do it at all on Shabbos unless we really have to and there's no choice whatsoever. So it'd be better to avoid. Shas Hadchak, the poskim say, because if for a baby, the baby needs it, you can't do it before Shabbos. It's permissible if you do two shinuyim. One, you put the ingredients in the opposite order. Obviously, the question is talking about applying hot water and milk to the dried flakes. That's the normal order. The flakes go in first. You switch it around, put the water or the milk in first and the flakes into the water or milk. That's number one. And number two, you have to change the way you mix the product, which means normally you take a spoon, go around and around and around until it becomes somewhat thicker. Here, you can't do that. Rather, you should do what the poskim say, shesi v'arev, you go horizontal and vertical, not in a circle. Chazanish says it's better to take the spoon out between the various, you know, horizontal and vertical swings. Shmir Shabbos quotes us in Perek Ches, Sif Tes. Finally, question 19. When people have rodents in the house, it is often after the birthing seasons. As such, often baby rodents are nesting in the house. If traps are applied, often the lactating mother who is out and about foraging for food is trapped and removed or euthanized. When this happens, it is likely to lead to the death of the babies who may not be able to move yet, depending on how old they are and what species they are. As a result, they will die of dehydration since they are unable to receive any nutrients, lacking their mother's milk. This is potential dehydration of the babies considered tzar balei chayim. All this is weighed against the damage that rodents can do to the inside of one's home. The rule is that we do not take into account tzar balei chayim when the countervailing point is tzar b'nei adam. We have to be careful about this. People are so much into animal rights, even when they trample on human rights. I believe there is a human right to live in a rodent-free house. No one wants to live in a house with rodents, no matter what species they are. And therefore, it seems to me that, yes, ideally, the best way is to remove the rodent by physically removing the rodent or killing the rodent with the minimum of tzar balei chayim. It should be done that way, of course. But if it cannot be done that way, and the alternative is to continue to have rodents in the house or to eliminate the rodents in a manner which will lead to a certain measure of tzar balei chayim, it is permissible to inflict the tzar balei chayim for the betterment of the residents of the house. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebbe. We hope we can call upon you again shortly. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.